Barry Dent's with us. His new work, The Sale of a Lifetime, How the Great Bubble Burst of 2017 Can Make You Rich. So we'll be back with Harry. We'll also take your questions and maybe your stories, too, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Harry Dent with us. We'll get to your calls as well. Harry, got to ask you one thing, though. Back in 1999, you came out with the bestseller, The Roaring 2000s. You had predicted a $35,000 Dow by 2008. What did you see to predict that, and what happened? Why didn't it happen?
Well, what we saw, we were the only ones that saw the first bubble in the 90s and the collapse of Japan at the same time, but the first bubble for the U.S. and Europe. And we were expecting a correction then to follow. Then we expected the baby boomers and then the movement mainstream of the internet would cause one more big bubble. And we thought it would be the same size. In fact, I came up with a new indicator called the geopolitical indicator when the Dow didn't go as high as I thought. I mean, earnings went just as strong as we thought and just as strong as the 90s bubble and the economy and all this sort of stuff. But since 9/11, the geopolitical environment and the risk perception of the world changed dramatically. And of course, we're still in that downward geopolitical cycle. I've got a geopolitical cycle that is positive for 17 to 18 years, like 1983 to 2000. And then it's adverse from 2001 through, in this case, about late 2019 or so. So we still got three or four more years of this kind of terrorism and civil wars around the world and complaints about police brutality. I mean, everything. I mean, what has gone right geopolitically since 9/11? So that was the game changer. What I found is that stock valuations in this negative geopolitical environment are half of what they are in the positive. And so that's where I had to make a big adjustment in my model. And that's one thing we do differently compared to a lot of people I respect, is when something doesn't happen the way we think, since we can project so many things in the future, then we know, God, we must be missing something. So that was a huge insight. Because the Dow, yeah, we had a mini bubble, yeah, and the stock market went up from late 2002 to late 2007, just like we said, but it went up half as much as I expected. And so now we've got that indicator. And again, that indicator's down. The demographics have been down since late 2007, as we predicted. We've got an innovation cycle that peaked in 2010 with the internet, and now Moore's Law is declining, and now it's more Facebook and social media rather than, I'd say, more powerful things for productivity like Google and email and stuff. And we have a boom-bust cycle around sunspots, and I'm the only one that figured out it was sunspots instead of just a clock-like cycle. And that has been pointing down since 2014, and that's when the stock markets suddenly stopped going straight up and have been going sideways. Next step in this downward boom-bust or sunspot cycle is we should see the worst in the next 3 years or 3.5 years before that turns around. So I now have over 30 years, one step at a time, I've added to the demographic, or what I call my spending wave cycles, that I came up with 88. And again, that alone was enough for me to see the collapse of Japan, along with the fact that they were the country that had all the bubbles in real estate and stocks then, not the rest of the world. But now I've got four indicators, and they all point down together. Some turn up earlier or later, but they're all down into around early 2020. So that says the next three and a half years is the greatest danger period. The only time this has happened in the last century or more is in the early 30s, in the Great Crash, the Great Depression, and the early to mid 70s when we had the next great crash in stocks and the whole OPEC oil thing and all this sort of stuff. So these cycles together give a more complete view than just the demographic cycles that I started with. And, you know, I'm like, that's how I learn, you know.
Well, we all do. Would a war change any of this, Harry?
Well, wars are more likely to come. And of course, we already have minor wars all over the world now. And you've got the biggest threat is Putin. It's hard for me to see World War III because there's not the alignment of powers that could fight something that big. But the most likely step up would be aggression from Putin as Europe weakens. How are they going to fight him off? And Russia, because of the commodity collapse, is one of the weakest countries in the world. And so Putin's got every incentive to expand into Ukraine and Crimea and other areas and in Eastern Europe, and that is something that could happen. I think, George, the biggest thing though for people to focus on is this Brexit and Trump. Because I see, you know, globalization has boomed since the 1970s. Well, globalization has peaked, just like the internet has peaked for now in major countries. And there's gonna be, U.K. was the first country to say, "Look, we're gonna break off. You know, we can't afford in a difficult world to have people streaming over our borders, and we can't afford, you know, to have somebody in Brussels that dictate our future and regulation." So they're the first to break off. This is gonna happen more and more in Europe. It's already happening in the Middle East. You got Sunni Shia splits in countries that are just not sustainable. And it's like globalization is gonna have to break down before it can grow again. And I think that's gonna happen over the next several years. And I think in the United States, I mean, the split between the more conservative and liberal parties, it has never been greater. And I don't see how we can go forward. It's almost like this country may break into a few different regions that have more similar social and financial values and stuff, because it's just night and day. Congress can't get anything done for one good reason. There's just too big a divide between the liberals and conservatives in this country and around the world. And of course, I could go on and on and on. I think this is going to be Brexit is the beginning of a worldwide trend, and the stock markets are totally asleep at the wheel to not see how big a trend this is. And again, Trump comes out of nowhere, I think mainly to save his apprentice empire that was falling, to try to get attention, and ends up may become president. That's how well he did, because there's such deep satisfaction, especially in the middle class and lower middle class, which have really lost out to foreign workers and immigrants, much more than even the 1% Wall Street trend, which Bernie Sanders was big on. But that's why Trump's hitting a chord. This is happening around the world. This is not just a Brexit thing, not just a U.S. thing. This is happening everywhere. China, you know, Hong Kong wants to break off from China. Taiwan wants to say, yeah, acknowledge that we're separate. Tibet and Mongolia want to break off.
They were happier before when the British controlled Hong Kong,
Yeah,
right?
they were. But because, I mean, in one of the telltale signs that we always emphasize, the smart money in China, the most affluent, you know, 1% to 10%, half of those people want to leave the country in the next 5 years. A lot of them already have, and they are moving their money out. They are laundering, and that I'm not using too strong a term there, laundering their money out of their country because they don't trust their top-down corrupt government. And they know they're in a bubble that's going to burst, and they know they're the ones going to be taxed to death and stuff. So they're buying real estate in English-speaking major cities, and under the guise of, oh, we're just sending our kids there for a good education, and they're buying Western businesses. That's how they're getting their money out of the country, because otherwise they can only take out $50,000 a year legally. But hey, they can buy a house, you know, for their kid in college, or if they move there while the kid's in college, they can buy a business. Well, one, I tell you, we're not far from the Chinese government cracking down on that, just like cities like Singapore and Vancouver and many more to come are cracking down and putting a foreign tax on Chinese and foreign buyers because they're killing real estate. People can't
Oh
afford
my
to live
God.
in their cities anymore because of these foreign
They're
buyers.
buying everything.
Yeah, buying everything, all cash. Why do they buy all cash? They're laundering their money out of their country. They don't want a mortgage.
Exactly. Let's take some calls here for you, Harry. They're lining up. We go to Indianapolis, Indiana, to start east of the Rockies. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how's the coming along with trying to get Hillary or Trump on the show?
I think the producers are working on that.
All right, cool. Hey, listen, of course, I got a 401k, and I'm sure I'll lose a big chunk of that again. But my question is more along the lines, and he was talking about how the country might split into different regions. With this all this falling apart, is it going to cause civil disobedience? But my question is, if the people understand what's going to happen and they have a run on the banks to withdraw their money, and all this crashes, is our money going to be worthless? And also, and I'll take my answer off the air. With the banks being Basel III compliant, how is that going to affect the withdrawal the people when they withdraw their money.
Well, again, that's one reason, Brian, that the real estate bubble is so much more damaging. Banks lend, the biggest area they lend, business and consumer, is into real estate with mortgages. And they can lend 10 times their capital or 10 times the 10% deposits they pledge, which are your deposits, not them. They're pledging your deposits, which is kind of stupid when you think about it. So that's how you get a bank run. If real estate fails enough and loans fail enough, they say they have your money, but they don't. They lend it out. And when they don't get enough of it back, that's when they say, oh, we can't give you all your money. So I'm not worried about the U.S. dollar collapsing anytime soon. It's the best house in a bad neighborhood. And the U.S. dollar did the best in 2008, as we warned the gold bugs, which already argue that the dollar's going to not. I'm not worried about the U.S. dollar going down in foreign market. I am worried about people not losing money suddenly in things like stock and real estate, and in some banks not being able to get your money out. So again, not only do you convert your money into safe assets, but you put it in an investment brokerage account in your name, and preferably with a firm that has nothing to do with real estate lending, real estate investment, or speculation like a lot of the big banks and brokerage firms and investment banks do. I have my money with Scottrade, and there's many firms like this. All they do is transactions. They don't lend money. They don't speculate. So they don't have any reason to lose the money, and it's in my name. You can't lend against an account in somebody's name. You can lend against a savings or checking account in a bank. So have minimum money in checking and savings account, maximum in a brokerage account in your name that is with a firm that does not speculate in any way in this huge bubble. Because most financial institutions aren't making money on lending now. They're speculating.
I have a guest, Terry, Jonathan Kahn, who wrote a book about the Shemitah, which is Jewish, of course, for a collapse. And he, of course, is predicting one. He thinks we're a little overdue. But to tie in with what you're saying, something's going to happen.
Yeah, no, again, history's crystal clear on this. Debt bubbles lead to financial asset bubbles, and the debt and the financial asset bubble burst. And here's where, you know, like what Brian said earlier, well, I'm sure I'm going to lose again. Here's the difference. In past downturns, when you lost money in stocks or something, real estate, it came back 3 years or seven, or this time it took even longer, 8 years later, to new highs. That's not going to happen this time. When stocks peaked in late 29, they went down 89%, number one, the most in all of U.S. history, but they didn't get back to those levels in 1929 until 1953. In other words, if you'd retired in 1929, you would have been dead before you got back even in your 401k plan, which didn't exist back then. So this is different. This is why you can't listen to your stockbroker in today's economy. This is a once-in-a-lifetime reset of all financial prices. Everything's going to go down pretty much, and you need to just get out of the way of it and protect your money until this reset happens, until you see bubbles go back to where they began, until you see markets down like commodities today, 70, 80%. Then you can feel good about investing long-term again and riding some of the cycles. This is not a cycle you want to sit through. That's the whole point of this book.
Next up, we go to Jeremy in Utah, west of the Rockies. Jeremy, you're on with us.
Hi, George and Harry.
Hi.
Virtually every prepper or doomsdayer advocates having gold and or silver for any type of collapse. Now, I'm swing trading in gold and silver mining stocks, hoping to capitalize on the potential burst, the bursting bubble. Now, is that strategy safe and or potentially profitable? And then kind of a quick follow-up on that is China switching to a gold standard, if that potentially happens with their money, would that affect the first question?
Well, first of all, the biggest thing driving gold and silver, they're still commodities. They peaked in 1980 with the commodity cycle. They peaked again. We call the top in silver on the day because it retested its 1980 commodity bubble cycle peak. And we said, hey, this is the time to start selling gold and silver. So we were dead on that. We've been saying gold and silver are bubbles. I argue against gold bugs like Peter Schiff. And he said, oh, this is a bubble. Then I said, well, what about gold, Peter? He said, well, gold's not a bubble. I said, Peter, gold went up seven times, you know, in 10, 11 years. What do you mean it's not a bubble? That is a bubble, and gold fits my bubble model, just like anything else. So gold has to reset. Gold is an inflation hedge. And if somebody, a prepper, wants to say, look, how do I survive and stuff, I'd rather have shotgun shells and bourbon bottles and basic food, canned tuna, to trade with people. What are you going to buy with a Krugerrand if you walk into a 7-Eleven in a major global crisis? Gold is not formal money. People may move for it to be, and certainly they might trust something like silver dimes or anything else, but there's better things to have. And we keep saying gold and silver did great in the 70s in our last crisis because it was an inflation crisis. When money gets destroyed from debt bubbles bursting and financial bubbles bursting, and I'm talking about literally, I've totaled up in this book, 100 to 120 trillion, that's not a typo, in financial assets and debt is probably going to disappear and be written off and not come back for a long time. That means less money in the whole system, and that's what resets prices. There's less money chasing the same goods. That is deflation. Gold and silver are not deflation hedges. In fact, the one thing that gold correlates with short term and all the way back to the 1600s is inflation. It doesn't appreciate without inflation, and it has no returns like real estate. Real estate's similar. If you adjust for inflation, real estate doesn't appreciate. But real estate can be rented out. Gold cannot.
I was going to just ask you, what do you think about buying apartment buildings during the bubble burst?
Well, I know a lot of people are making money. If you do it, you have to do it systematically. In other words, everything's going to go down, including apartment buildings. But apartment buildings have held up, some have appreciated, will hold up better because the more people can't buy or lose their real estate or get kicked out of the house, the more they're going to rent. But the thing to do is say, look, I only buy apartment buildings if there's strong positive cash flow now and you think they could still at least be modestly positive cash flow even if the economy got bad and rents went down some. And then as the economy fails more, you can take your profits and cash flow from those apartment buildings and buy more as they go down. So that is definitely the best sector of real estate. And once we see the real crash come in the next 3 to 6 years in real estate, the baby boomers got one more round of vacation home and retirement home buying. That's going to be a good sector. And I'll tell you, you could buy nursing homes or invest in nursing homes the rest of your life and do nothing but make money because the baby boomers are just starting to enter that market next year. And there'll be a 25, 30 year boom, just like they bubbled every, the baby boom generation is a bubble generation. And the biggest thing they're going to be doing is healthcare and things like nursing homes in the coming decade.
All right, Harry, we're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM and take some more final phone calls here as we talk about his work. The Sale of a Lifetime just came out, and we're the first national interview for Harry on this incredible book. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with Harry Dent, The Sale of a Lifetime, his latest book. Harry, of all the things you've been through as a financial guru, what scares you the most financially?
Well, you know, again, the fact that I know that this is a once-in-a-lifetime great reset. And again, I show that, you know, there's been four in history, and we're about, you know, back to the 1800s, and we're about to see the fifth one. The scary thing is that everything goes down there, and there's nowhere to hide, and asset allocation and diversification doesn't work. But I tell you, more than that, George, basically what you're just talking about, When that sort of thing happens, I mean, the Great Depression was way worse than the 1970s. And because you saw 25% unemployment and people living in their cars and you saw the Dust Bowl and all this sort of stuff. And in addition to that sort of economic and financial downturn, we have this incredible political divide, which to me, the only time we've seen that in U.S. history to this degree was in the Civil War. So you've got this kind of, you also have this geopolitical cycle that continues down and some other cycles I have that say, hey, we're getting ready for kind of a revolution, kind of like a second American revolution and sort of thing over the next several years. And so, you know, where you live and how safe you can be is and prepared for whatever happens, and I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but I think you can't be too safe. And so you have to protect your financial assets first, but then you got to consider, gosh, I mean, I moved to Puerto Rico since I talked to you last, and it's a bankrupt country, but I say at least they know they're bankrupt. And I think we have much more potential for civil unrest in the United States because of the political divide. And man, I wouldn't even touch China with a 10-foot pole with 250 million unskilled workers, unregistered citizens trapped in their cities with nowhere to go when that bubble bursts. So, I mean, civil unrest is going to be part of this to some degree. And in the U.S., I think politically is ripe for that. And that's why we've got such a divide politically in Congress and in this election. Is so strange. I mean, you've got two of the most, two of the candidates with the highest hate ratings running against each other, and so I think, you know, hey, if you can live in the outer edges of your city, better. If you can live in the inner part of this country rather than on the coast, where and if you can live in cities that didn't bubble up so much and won't have as many real estate collapses and people homeless or kicked out of their homes, just think about that stuff. I mean, there's obviously places that are safer than others, you know, and some people are moving down in the Caribbean and stuff, so especially aging baby boomers. So it's really a time to look at your whole life and say, gosh, well, what can I do to protect myself? And I'm just trying to say, look, I'm not a bearish person. I was the most bullish guy. And actually, my biggest error in forecasting was being too bullish, as you pointed out earlier, you know, in that bubble from 2002 to 2007. I'm not a bearish person. I just look at cycles. I look at reality. And once in a lifetime, you get a great reset like this, and you just can't underestimate it. The whole point of the book, don't underestimate this. Do not listen to your stockbroker. Most of the time, fine. They'll keep you from panicking in a 20% correction. That's what good financial advisors do. Almost no financial advisor is going to tell you the right thing to do here because nobody's going to see this coming. It's just going to come out of left field. Yeah. They're going to call it a black swan. I'm saying it's not a black swan. We're predicting this just like we predicted the great boom of the 90s when everybody thought the U.S. was done and Japan was going to take over the world. We said the opposite. And so, you know, this is a time to take this seriously and look at everything in your life. How can I protect what I have? How can I protect my family? And if you got a good job and you hate your boss, well, be nice to your boss anyway. This is not a time to go jump from your job. And if you can create extra streams of income on the side, do that in every way possible. Just the secret to a deflationary period like this, again, once in a lifetime, cash and cash flow, because only people with cash and cash flow can take advantage of the sale of a lifetime, which is going to come in the next 3 years or maybe a few years to follow in some sectors. I mean, it's you can make extreme wealth in a short period of time by buying things at 10, 20, 30 cents on the dollar.
Would you be shocked if nothing happened?
Yes, I would. I mean, now the only thing, the only other counterexample is Japan's been in this. Japan went in this bubble first and burst first, and they've been on quantitative easing nonstop since 1997 when their demographics totally, you know, went off the cliff, as I pointed out. They've just kind of been in a coma economy. Their real estate's still down 60-some%, never bounced. Their stocks are still down 60%, and we're down 80% at worst, and are going to go down again. Their financial assets restructured, but their debt never restructured. Their economy's just been at zero growth, zero inflation. I call it a coma economy. That's the other thing that could happen. In that sort of scenario, there's no way that financial assets are going to hold up, but governments may just kind of keep pushing this debt deleveraging down the road, which is very, very unhealthy. You know, your body, when you eat something bad or somehow get exposed to something toxic, your body gets rid of it as quickly as possible. That's what happened in the Great Depression, flushed out all these debts and bubbles. That's what started to happen in 2008, and governments just said, no, we're going to stop it. This is extremely unhealthy. The longer governments fight this, the worse they make it. If we had gone through this crisis in 2008 and let debt restructure and let these bubbles burst and not pumped up the economy with artificial free money, we would have been over this by now and coming out the other side.
All right, back to the phones we go. Let's go to Jeff in Mesa, Arizona. Hey, Jeff, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, George. First-time caller.
Thanks, Jeff.
I tried to call you from on the Rockies today to be the first Coast caller from on the Rockies. Not east nor west, but I couldn't.
Right on them. That's good.
But I wanted to just have a little bit of a conversation because I feel like I went through this in my personal life, and I see it here locally in my hometown here. First of all, I see a lot of businesses here. I mean, the commercial businesses in Mesa, which is a pretty big bedroom community for Phoenix. We have a 400,000-plus population. I mean, there's so many shuttered commercial stores that, like, Kmart's have shuttered. Stores that have been around for 20, 30, 40 years here in Mesa are now... They just
gone. Sports Authority, all over the place.
Sports Authority is another one, yeah. And so nothing's really taken the place of these big commercial buildings, and it's kind of going to be an eyesore, maybe. But here's, I guess, my little – and here I want to give you a little background for what I went. I was in civil engineering, so I took it hard in 2009. I was laid off.
Uh-huh.
Now I went and kind of redid myself, and I'm in the healthcare. I've gotten to medical school, luckily enough, and I'm older. I'm trying to finish my degree and then go into psychiatry.
Good for you.
But here's the deal. Here's a couple thoughts I had, and I want to I guess hear some of your thoughts too, because I think this is a fascinating subject. First of all, is this correction that would happen is pretty soon after the first correction that you're saying didn't quite get it done. It wasn't a good enough correction. And so I think people psychologically could be really, really hurt by that because people are just, I mean, there's a lot of people still suffering and never
sure.
quite stopped suffering since 2009.
They could get wiped out.
And, if that happens again, I don't know how people could take that psychologically. Second of all is, what if Donald Trump does become president? What about the stimulating effects of infrastructure, like building a wall perhaps, or maybe redoing some of our nation's bridges or freeways, and perhaps lowering the corporate tax rate so that businesses come back from overseas. My wife's from Costa Rica, and there's a ton of businesses down there, Amazon, Bank of America, IBM, Western Union are four that I can name off the top of my head. They're down there in Costa Rica and have a big presence and pay their workers down there $5 an hour, you know. But if you lower that corporate tax rate here, maybe some of those businesses will come back and bring some, you know, those customer service jobs back and maybe some middle management jobs back. Could it be that if Donald Trump becomes president and some of these things happen, you know, we'll have the construction sector of the economy stimulated?
What do you think of that? I got to get to another call pretty soon. But, Harry, what do you think of that?
Yeah, real quickly, yes. Infrastructure is the best thing to do. We're lowest interest rates of a lifetime long term for this sort of stuff. The problem is we're already fully urbanized. We just need to kind of fill in some gaps. That's not enough to offset the massive decline we're going to see elsewhere. But that is one of the best things that can be done is governments, instead of printing free money, instead of bailing out companies, invest in infrastructures at the lowest interest rates in history. I mean, you're talking like treasury bonds at 1-2% for 30 year and build stuff that'll pay off for decades and create jobs now. But there's only so much of that you can do compared to the size of our economy. So that's not going to turn around the economy totally, but it is one of the useful things. Lowering taxes, encouraging companies. You're going to see protectionism around the world. That's what happened in the 30s.
Oh, sure.
So things like that to get companies to come back home, that'll happen. So Trump's in the right direction on that. Deporting 11 million illegal aliens is the worst thing you could do at this time. That would cause a depression on its own. So I like some of the things he's saying. I don't like others. But, yeah, you need to do things. What is bad is just covering over the problem with free money and bailing out stuff instead of letting this reset. The economy wants to reset. It wants to get rid of bubbles. It wants to reduce healthcare costs. Healthcare is ridiculously expensive, and education makes that look like nothing. This reset will fix those inflation bubbles and key services. It'll fix these financial bubbles that make it impossible for a young family now to buy a home in so many cities. this reset is necessary. We did nothing but grow after the Great Depression, but it was three difficult years. I'm just telling people, you can't prevent this or stop it. Donald Trump is not going to create 4 million jobs a year. I don't care what he does, and I'm promising you that. But he will look a lot better if he comes in and does this sort of stuff than somebody like Hillary Clinton, who does the same old thing, and then the Federal Reserve tries to, you know, jumpstart the economy.
And what about the psychology, Harry, of another hit?
Well, that's a great point that he's making here. People have already been hit twice in the early 2000s and then 2008 and 9 with two major crashes. And another one, that's what causes stock markets not to come back and financial for a long time. Most investors just leave the market and say, I'm never buying real estate again. I'm never buying stocks again. I'm never buying gold again. I'm never buying commodities. That's what happens. Not only does, you know, do prices go way down, but people, it takes a long time for investors to come back. All this leverage on Wall Street is going to be wiped out, so these gunslingers aren't going to have trillions of dollars to throw around anymore. That's why I'm saying stocks, the next crash is going to be the last one. And stocks, they're not going to come roaring back to new highs. So you better get your money out of your 401k into safe stuff now. You better get out of real estate that you're not in love with or going to live in forever. And even that, I've been renting my primary home since late 2005 when we predicted this bubble crash in real estate, and it's going to get worse, as I said earlier.
You've been renting for yourself, or you're renting it out?
No, I've been renting my primary home in Florida, in Tampa, and now in San Juan, Puerto Rico. I do own, guess what, my getaway on an island in the Caribbean, because that's my getaway and my safe place.
Do you rent that at all?
No.
Okay.
I rent it out now, but if things get bad, I can move there. And that's where I'll have my, you know, storage of good goodies and stuff. I mean, so that's strategic to me. That's my getaway place. And the zoning has changed there, which means no matter what happened to real estate, I would still not lose money on that place, because now I got five lots to sell down the road instead of one. But the point is, I've been willing to rent my primary home because I'm serious about why would I want to. I told my wife when we moved to Tampa, ultimately, the downside of that real estate, given the size of the bubble and our bubble models, is 70%. Are you willing to lose that for the privilege of owning for several years? And we said no.
Nobody wants to do that. Some people's homes are still underwater from the last one.
Exactly, yeah.
Let's go to John, truck driving in Oklahoma. Did you feel a little earthquake out there, John?
Yes, sir. I talked to you with old Gladys there last couple of weeks ago, and yeah, we still surviving that little old earth tremor there. We had some fracking doing all over here.
All righty.
And that had something to do with it. But, Harry, your own point, man, your own point. And, George, we need to get you at the BOK down here so you can challenge Trump in Oklahoma and Tulsa. I got a question about the trucking industry. Is that going to affect the rates as far as, you know, the main trucking as owner-operators? I know this is one of the, like, the 70% of, you know, transportation is through trucking.
Yeah.
And we provide the world, you know. So I just want to know about the rates and how is that going to affect. Is the rates going to fall out through the bottom, or are they going to expand? Because I remember back in the early 2000, during that 2001, I was with a buddy on his truck. We were running out to Salinas, California, coming back across, and we was getting like $7,000-$8,000, you know, and it just went all the way down to like $3,000 or $4,000, and it was just totally hilarious. But I just want to know that, and I'll take my questions off the line.
You got it. Go
ahead,
Harry.
Yeah, there's no question. Rates are going to get squeezed for just about everybody except for nursing homes and things that are just such strong demographics. And so that's, again, I mean, businesses that hunker down and survive, that's one whole chapter of the book, will see their market share grow dramatically. Even if they're losing money or struggling, all you got to do is survive. But I also tell people, if you got a business that's doing well now and you don't want to sit through this thing, or you don't want to hand it down to your kids, this is a good time to sell something while you still get a lot for it. But yes, you got to plan on rates going down and more than last time, more than they did in the early 2000s or 2008-9. This should be the deepest crash we see in our lifetimes, and deeper than the two last bubbles bursting before this one. So that's just reality. That's what you got to plan on. Can I survive, and what can I do to survive if things are worse than the last downturns you've been through?
Harry, where did we get your book? Of course, The Sale of a Lifetime. Amazon, you mentioned. Any other places yet?
Yeah, well, we're releasing exclusively with Amazon at first, so that's the place to get it. You can also go to harrydent.com, and we've got a free daily newsletter, and of course you can get the book on our website as well. But I just find, God, Amazon's hard to beat.
They're doing well. Did they publish for you, or did you do it?
No, this is the first time since 1989 that we self-published, my company self-published this book, because we're doing all the selling. We're doing all the media. We have massive mailing lists through our newsletter and our promotions and stuff. And publishers don't do much good for us anymore. All they do is get us into a bunch of little mom-and-pop bookstores that we don't sell in anyway. We sell most of our stuff through Amazon and big stores like Barnes & Noble anyway, and we can get in then. So, yeah, we're self-publishing for
right.
the first time.
Of course, I still love the mom-and-pop bookstores. They're still a staple of communities, aren't they?
They're more fun. It's just we don't sell as many books there.
Well, you deal in a different subject matter for
yeah.
most people. And website?
HarryDent.com.
That's simple enough. Harry, thanks for being on the program. Keep in touch with us, and if you see more signs that something's going to happen, get back to us, would you?
We will.
All right, that's Harry Dent. Name of the book, The Sale of a Lifetime. When we come back in just a moment, we're going to talk about Bigfoot, encounters in New York and New England. This is going to be fun. Paul Bartholomew joins me, and I'm really looking forward to this. I haven't talked about Bigfoot and Sasquatch in months, so let's do that when we come back. And we've got some pictures up at the coasttocoastam.com website. Go take a look right before we come back.